Good evening, everyone. It's great to be with you. Obviously, I'm sitting here inside the shul at the Young Israel Southfield with the mechitza behind me. We are at a very exciting time at our shul's history because we are in the process, God willing, soon of renovating our main sanctuary. And that will include, God willing, all new seats and carpeting, but also included in the project is a plan to renovate and to hopefully completely change our mechitza. And so what I want to do this evening is to talk a little bit about mechitza, a little bit about the history of mechitzas, the halacha behind mechitzas, and the hashkafa of mechitzas. And there's actually a great place to speak about the mechitza, not only here at Young Israel Southfield, but specifically here in southeastern Michigan, in the greater metropolitan Detroit area, because many of us are familiar, there was a major court battle regarding mechitza back in the 50s, a shul not here in Southfield, but just to the east of us, east in Mount Clemens. I never forget, I once was in the shul in Mount Clemens, unfortunately for a funeral for Levaya, when Alan Schwartz, our member, when his father, unfortunately, was nifter, he passed away. So the funeral took place at the shul. And I'll never forget the rabbi who was there at the time. He spoke and he said, "We're the only synagogue east of John R. in metropolitan Detroit, the claim to fame." So that was one claim to fame for the Mount Clemens Synagogue. But the other one is that there was this major battle in the 1950s when the majority of the synagogue members, if I understand correctly, wanted to remove the mechitza, and there was a small minority of members who wanted it to remain. It ultimately went to a court. Initially, several lower courts ruled in favor of the majority of the synagogue members to remove the mechitza, but ultimately the Michigan Supreme Court ruled in favor of the minority of view of the members who wanted the mechitza to remain. The courts, of course, did not rule on the halachic issues, which we'll discuss in a moment, but rather it had to do with the rights of members in terms of the minority, if the majority wants to change the status quo. So ultimately the court ruled, and I quote, "A change of view on religious subjects did not require those who still held to older views to surrender property originally conveyed to them." So it was based upon a property and ownership and membership. And long story short, then the court did rule in favor of to keep the mechitza, and for a time being that did continue to exist and to occur. Of course, ultimately a book was published regarding this entire episode, The Sanctity of the Synagogue, by Baruch Litvin, who was the major player for advocating for the that the mechitza should remain. So that's one thing that took place here in the greater Detroit area. And the other is something I just came across this past week as I was preparing for the shiur. My Rebbe of Herschel Schechter, in one of his svarim that he wrote about the Rav Soloveitchik, tells the following story, and I'll read it to you. He says, "The Haisa Mishpacha be Detroit. There was a family in Detroit. Shispalla be Beis HaKnesses Conservativi. There was this family in Detroit that davened in a conservative congregation. Asher Haya bo Snif Me'ergon Hakiruv NCSY, but also had a connection to NCSY. It sounds like, and I spoke to Jane Ivetsky about this a little earlier, just to get the facts. This could be referring to the B'nai David Synagogue on Southfield Road that also had a minion, an NCSY minion that they started. That minion, NCSY minion, had a mechitza. The main sanctuary did not have a mechitza. So here's the story. I don't know who this story is about. So maybe someone knows who this actually occurred to, but no names are given. The story goes, Haben HaBachor Shalahem Yiskarev L'Torahs L'Mitzvos, that the firstborn son in the family, the family was a conservative family, and the firstborn son, maybe through NCSY, became more observant and became a fully observant Torah in Mitzvos. L'Shalcho L'Lumot B'Yeshiva, and he was sent to learn in Yeshiva. B'Nila Ben Torah Mitin, and became a true Ben Torah. right? A God-fearing Jew and observance of Torah mitzvot. Now what happened? Binam had tzair haya omed lichko des habar mitzvah shalo. Bisham is also basic nesses. And it happened to be his younger brother was turning bar mitzvah, and the bar mitzvah celebration was going to take place in the main sanctuary of this conservative shul, Asher Yoshim Mispalim Sham Bitaruvos, where there was no mechitza, where the men and women were sitting together. The Habena Mavugar, and the older son, who now became Orthodox and was observant of Torah and mitzvah, Shaul Rabbeinu, he went to the, I guess he was at Yeshiva University, or he went, somehow he went to, the Rasalavachik. In Mutter Lo Lishtati B'Simcha Yachan Mishpachto, he wanted to know, can he join in this celebration? Can he be with his family sitting in the shul where there's mixed seating at his brother's bar mitzvah? That was the question. We'll see in a moment, Rav Soloveitchik was very opposed, extremely opposed for people entering a synagogue, a temple, a synagogue that didn't have mechitza. To the extent we'll see, he went so far as even when a person couldn't fulfill the mitzvah of tekiya shofar, he didn't allow a person to enter the conservative shul, or a shul without a mechitza. But now there's a personal problem, right? The young man, the student in yeshiva, who now had a it was a family simcha. It could be a whole family machlokas here. So what did Rav Soloveitchik say? Rabbeinu heishiv lo shelo yispalo shama. So the Rav said you cannot daven there. He told the older son you can't daven there. But what can he do? He should daven somewhere else. B'Shabbos b'Bokir, b'Shabbos Mekudemes. Go somewhere else where the Hashkama minyan. You know, go somewhere with an earlier davening, a Nate's minyan. Below Yisa l'Sham b'Rechev. And also, when you go, you can don't travel by car. The Shachter says it must be that he lived a little bit of a distance away from this shul. So Ella Yech b'Regel, you have to walk there. You can't drive there. When you are then there to be with your family, play along, stand up when the congregation rises, sit down when the congregation sits. It shouldn't be an outward appearance. You shouldn't make any appearance that you're not really participating. You'd be us, that wouldn't look good. But don't daven anything with them. And not only should you not daven el velo yana afilo amen yishmei rabba. Don't even answer amen to a bracha or to kaddish. Ella aval shalol dishtativ klab bar mitzvah ein zeh nachon. But not to be there at all. Soloveitchik felt it wasn't appropriate. Again, family. So ulbasof af also. And then just to end off the story, Rav Shachter says, turns out the bar mitzvah boy who was selling his bar mitzvah, the younger brother. He also loved to be yeshiva. He also became a Baal Tshuva. He also went to learn yeshiva. The Gam came Nasa, the Ben Torah Miti, and also became a true Ben Torah. So, I don't, that's again, Shach just said he heard the story. I don't know who it's about, but another story regarding Mechitza that apparently occurred here in of all places in metropolitan Detroit, not far from our own shul. So, let's take a step back and try to understand, you know, what is this all about, and the issue of mechitza. And first, just a little bit of history. We know traditionally, and certainly we have records going back deep into the early Middle Ages, that synagogues, that shuls, places where Jews gathered, there was a mechitza. There was a mechitza. Men and women sat separately. Sometimes women didn't come to shul at all, but where women did come, there was some sort of mechitza, a balcony, some form of separation between men and women. In fact, even in Germany itself, with the early advent of Reform Judaism, even there, we know in 1845, the Berlin Reform congregation in Berlin, they removed their mechitza, but they did not allow men and women to sit together. They just removed the mechitza. Furthermore, the famous Hamburg Temple, which is where Reformed Judaism really began in Germany in the early 1800s, as late as the earliest 20th century, there was a movement. There was actually someone who gave a very significant donation, but it was a contingent upon allowing mixed pews, allowing men and women to sit together, and they refused the money. And there wasn't a mechitza, but they did not allow men and women to sit together. This is in Germany, Reformed Germany, in early 20th century. Where did mixed pews in Judaism really begin? So it wasn't in Germany, but it was right here in the United States of America. That's where it began, with Reform synagogues here in America. In fact, it's generally considered that the first synagogue that had mixed pews was in Albany, New York. In 1851, Professor Jonathan Sarna has a very nice article about the history of mechitzas, or lack thereof, in synagogues in America. And he says that the synagogue called Anshe Emes, that was actually founded by a very famous figure in American Jewry, Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, who's really considered like the founder of Reform Judaism in America. He eventually moved to Cincinnati, and there he founded the Hebrew Union College, and really is the driving force of Reform Judaism in America. Well, the shul that he had in Albany in 1851, which was a second congregation, it's a long story why he had a second congregation in Albany. There were some disagreements in his previous shul, again, nothing new with rabbis and congregations having an issue sometimes. But nonetheless, this Anshe Emes, they had family pews, men and women sitting together. Professor Sarna does point out there is some question whether that was intentional or that they just happened to purchase an old church with that just didn't have a mechitza in it. And so they just, it just happened. The people, just when they came in the first service, the men and women sat together, but not necessarily that was like the intent. So there's a discussion about that. Nonetheless, Rabbi Meir Weiss later in life proudly pointed out and was very, he always would say that, he was one who initiated the mixed pews. We generally assume that these mixed pews came into existence, says Professor Sarna, because Jews in America often changed their practices based upon what they saw the larger society around them doing. And whether it's the introduction of the organ into the synagogue, or whether here it's the removal of mechitzah and mixed pews, that was what was happening in Protestant churches all throughout America. As early as the mid-18th century, this was taking place in churches, and Jews often looked over their shoulders and wanted to feel accepted by their American neighbors or fellow citizens, and many changes even in of decorum, of speaking in English, shortened prayers, all different types of changes that took place in synagogues in America were often as a result of trying to follow what was happening in churches and tried to feel accepted in America. And so we generally assume that that's how this how developed, removal of mechitza and mixed family pews. And just there's a lot more to say about this, but just to fast forward to the 1950s, we know that there were major battles between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism at that time, whole question about the survival of Orthodoxy. And that's where you have like this case in Mount Clemens. There was another major court battle in Cincinnati, another one in New Orleans. Interestingly, the one in New Orleans, the one in Cincinnati, went in favor, unlike the one in Mount Clemens, of those who wanted the mechitza removed and in favor of the mixed pews. But again, this is all playing itself out in America, in the United States of America. And again, the defining characteristic certainly wasn't the only characteristic, but often the most visible characteristic would separate an Orthodox synagogue from a non-Orthodox synagogue was the mechitza. It became like the issue. Again, there are lots of other things as well that separated them, but it was what was most visible. We'll see in a moment. Renowned figures such as Rav Soloveitchik or Moshe Feinstein, who are living at that time, they're battling very hard and with very strong language, are condemning those who are removing mechitzas, who are davening in shuls that don't have mechitzas. So that's a little bit about the historical background. Now the question is, so where did it come from? Where's the notion of mechitza? If you look in the Torah, there's no mitzvah, thou shalt have a mechitza in one's synagogue. So where did it come from? So a couple things. So first of all, some like to point out to a story early on in the Torah with Yitzchak and Rivka, when they are davening for a child, it says l'nochach ishto, that the Yitzchak daven l'nochach ishto, which some translate as opposite his wife, or perhaps that some say that Yitzchak was on one side of the room and Rivka was on the other side of the room. So you already see a story where men and women are praying, but they're praying separately from one another. Now, we don't necessarily see a machitza there, but we do see a division, a separation. That could be, again, one possible just a biblical source for all of this. There is a Gemara Maseches Kedushin which says the following. Gemara says, Abaye is in Daf Pei Aleph Amid Aleph. Abaye Dayer Gulfe. That Abaye would arrange rows of jugs to separate men and women. And Rashi says, why was he separating men and women? Makom kivutos anashim v'nashim, o ledrasha o lechuppa. When men and women would come together, either for a drasha, they'd come for a shir. People come to shul to hear the rabbi speak, to hear a guest speaker, the scholar in residence. So when men and women would come together to hear a shir, or they would come together at a chuppah, at a wedding celebration, Abaye would put this row of jugs down the middle to keep the men and women separate. It's interesting, this is outside this is not referring to prayer. This is, again, attending a shir or at a wedding. Gemara continues, Rava Dayer Kana. Rava would place reeds down the middle. And Rashi explains, before she explained, that that the reeds and the jugs were the jugs were there even to make noise, that if someone would try to jump across, or if someone would try to sneak across, you would knock over a jug, it would shatter, and everyone would look at you, and obviously you'd run back to your side. Or the reeds would to catch you, so you wouldn't there wouldn't be any mingling. And then, just as a quick aside, the Gemara concludes, Amar Avin Sikva Dishasa Rigla. Rabbi Avin said that the one of the worst times during the year is Yontif. There's no worse time than Yontif. What's so bad about Yontif? I thought Yontif is wonderful, Simcha, joy. Rashi explained, Sheish Kfutos Anashim and Nashim. You know what happens on Yontif? People aren't working, and men and women are hanging out together all the time. You saw a drasha. Where are they hanging out? Are they hanging out at Six Flags? Are they hanging out at a concert? No, they're hanging out. They're going to shirim together. What a terrible thing, right? Men and women are going to a shir together. Right? They're going to the Shabbos Agudal shir, the Shabbos Shuvah shir, drasha. But what happens when they go to the shir? Rashi says this. Vinostim zemzeh. They're all hanging out and talking to one another. It's and says Tosfos, not only are they hanging out together, they are nosin ayin alzeh. They're looking at each other, flirting, whatever it is they're going on. And therefore, says Tosfos, some of us may be familiar with this, l'chein nagu lisanos achar Pesach l'achos Sukkos. That's why there's a custom that some have to fast after Pesach and after Sukkos. We're familiar with Bahab, right? The Monday and Thursday and Monday in the beginning of the month of Iyar, the beginning of the month of Cheshvan, that some people fast and say Slichos. What are they fasting saying Slichos? Because of this. Because of this, the inappropriate behavior, the mixture of the sexes of men and women that are taking place during the holiday. So you see already from this Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin that there's perhaps a need and a requirement to separate men and women when they come together. Now, the major source regarding this entire issue is a Gemara, a Mishnah and Gemara in Maseches Sukkah. Let me get the exact text in front of me to read it to you, because this really is the source that everyone quotes and everyone cites when it comes to this issue. So it's a Gemara in Daf Nun Aleph and Daf Nun Beis, where we're told of the following. So it's talking about the famous Simchas Pesach Shoeva, the famous celebration that would take place nightly at the Beis HaMikdash throughout the Sukkos, when they would bring up the water. They would go down, today you go down to Ir David and you see the water that's there, and they would bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, and they would pour the water on next to the Mizbeach. There's a whole question where the ceremony comes from. We assume it's a Mesorah, a tradition to engage in this ceremony. And they would make a big deal out of it. They would make a huge celebration. The Gemara describes the juggling and the dancing that would take place. We know that the Gemara explains that the Tzedukim and the Sadducees were the reason why they made such a big deal is because the Sadducees said the whole thing was made up. They said it's not in the Torah. The rabbis are making up this ceremony, and the rabbi said no, it's a Mesorah, it's a tradition, and therefore they made a big deal about it to show that it was right, it was correct. So they had this whole celebration, and then the Mishnah says that umisaknen sham tikun gadol, that in preparation for the celebration, right after the first yontif, the first night after yontif is over, they would make a big tikkun. They would make fix something or correct something or institute something. The Gemara immediately asked, "My tikkun gadol, what were they making? What were they doing?" Amar Rebbe Lazar. So Rebbe Lazar says, "Yeah, this is the key Gemara." But also Shoshanino, we learned the following: a Mishnah Midos Chalka Haisa Barishona. Originally, in the Beis HaMikdash, the walls were very smooth. Some of the major outer courtyard, the Ezras Nashim, it was smooth. The walls were smooth. However, the Kifua Gustra, but they for this ceremony they would make a balcony. And they said that the women should sit on top on the balcony, and the men would be down below. Okay. In the Beis HaMikdash, Simchas Beis HaShoeva, thousands of Jews probably were there to gather to celebrate. They added on a balcony so that the women would be on top and the men would be down below. And they said Rashi explains they chiseled into the walls of these anchors, but they would then put planks on top to create this balcony. The Gemara then continues, Tanur Rabbanan, and we have another source that also says this, Barishona hayu nashim b'bifnei v'nashim b'chutz, v'yubon l'dei kalas rosh. Yiskinu shiyu nashim yoshos b'mechutz v'nashim b'fnei v'dayin hayu b'yin l'dei kalas rosh. They thought there was a problem, right? They're having this huge celebration. And just quickly, parenthetically, I believe, this all took place in the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, I believe. The reason why I think it did not take place in the first Beis HaMikdash is because the Sadducees only made a big deal about this when they were around in the period of the second temple. So that's when they made this, they always did the ceremony with the water, but the big dancing and celebration, that was just done in reaction to the Sadducees to show that this is our Mesorah, this is comes from God, this is not made up. So it was at the second temple where there's now this need. You have thousands of Jews coming for the celebration. And so originally, the men and women were all hanging out together. So initially, they wanted the men on the inside, the women on the outside. It didn't work. Then they switched it. Nothing was working. There was still this chaos and men and women together. So what do they do? So eventually, they said, we're going to make a balcony, the women on top, the men down below. So then the Gemara says something very important. Heichi avid hachi, how do they do this? How do they make changes in the Beis HaMikdash? Right? How are they making these renovations and changing the physical layout of the temple? Vaksiv, but there's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim that says, Akol kiksav miyad Hashem alai haskil. When David and Shlomo, they built the Beis HaMikdash, it was all based on what the prophets told them to do. They couldn't change anything. They couldn't make anything different. Like right now, we're in the parshios of the Mishkan, right? You have to do it exact. The Torah is very specific. Whatever God says, whatever I tell you to do, how you make the kalim, how to make the building, that's what you do. You can't make your changes. You think it'd be nicer to put the mizbeach, a little further to the left, further to the right. You can't do it. Wherever I tell you to do it, that's where you need to place it. So how do they make this change to the Beis HaMikdash? So Rav responded, Kra Ashichu. No, because there was another pasuk that they found. What was the pasuk? A pasuk in Zechariah. Zechariah says, the Safta Oretz Mishpachos Levad, Mishpachos Beis David, Levad, Rishayim Levad Amru. That in the future, there's going to be a time of mourning. Rashi actually says, very fascinating, this is referring to the beginning of the period of the Mashiach, when initially, before Mashiach ben David, there'll be Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef, things will be going well, and all of a sudden he'll be killed in battle. There'll be terrible sadness and mourning, and there'll be a huge levaya, a huge funeral, and all Jews will be coming to partake in the funeral. There'll be men in there and women there, and it's Pasuk says explicitly the men should be in one area, the women on another area, not together. So says the Gemara, you can learn out from this clearly that in the Beis HaMikdash there should certainly be this separation. Why? Because Mala Asid Lavo Shaoskin Behesped and Yitzhara Sholipam, in the future they're gonna be mourning, they're gonna be sad. There's also a tradition that the Yitzhara won't be as powerful in the future. And nonetheless, Amr Torah Nashim Levav Nashim Levad, and still in the future it says the men, even in a moment of sadness where Rashi says you're not gonna expect people to be, you know, jovial and mingling and you know, and acting inappropriately, and yet still in such a situation the men and women should sit separately. So certainly, says, concludes the Gemara, that Achshav, now, Shaoskim b'simcha, now when you're engaged in simcha and joy, right, the simcha's based on Shoeva, and the Yitzhahara is so powerful, alachas kama v'kama. So certainly, one is certainly required and should, in fact, have a separation between men and women. This is the source, right? This is the separation that was created inside the Beis HaMikdash. And furthermore, the Meforshim point out, if there was a separation between men and women in the Beis HaMikdash, so it follows that in every Beis HaKnesses, there should also be a separation. Because after all, the Gemara Megillah tells us that every shul is a Mikdash Ma'at, is a miniature sanctuary. And this idea of every shul being a miniature sanctuary is not only a nice homiletical teaching, but it's actually a halachic teaching. In fact, I actually went to Mincha Maariv about a month or two ago in shul. We discussed some of the halachic aspects of a synagogue, and many things that within the shul are patterned after the Beis HaMikdash. For example, ideally the doors are supposed to be on the opposite side of the Aron Kodesh, because of the Beis HaMikdash, right? The entrance was on the, you came in from east going towards west, opposite the Aron, that was all the way towards the west. And again, the center was the doors towards the entering into the Beis HaMikdash. Furthermore, the position of the Bima, and the fact they have a menorah, and the position of the Aron being in the center as well, not using the shul as a shortcut, just like you're not allowed to use a Beis HaMikdash as a shortcut, and on and on and on. There are many, many halachos of a shul that are patterned after a Beis HaMikdash. So the argument goes, just like in the Beis HaMikdash, when they saw the need to create a set, that there were men and women were there together, and they therefore had to create a barrier, a separation, so too in our shuls, when men and women come together, we need to have a mechitza as well. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, who there's many tshuvas that he has regarding mechitza, he argues that a mechitza is actually a din d'oraisa. He argues that it's a biblical mandate. It doesn't say explicitly that, you know, thou shalt have a mechitza, but he says clearly the fact that we know that you're not allowed to change the Mishkan, change the base of the Mikdash, and yet you see from the Gemara that they put in the balcony, clearly it shows that on a Torah level, this is necessary. This is required. Otherwise, it would be violating the principle of not altering the Mishkan or the base of Mikdash. That's the opinion. So Moshe Feinstein held is a mitzvah d'oraisa, it's a biblical commandment to have the mechitza. Rav Soloveitchik also felt it was a biblical requirement to have mechitza for a very different reason. And this goes back to the history and certainly what was happening in America in the 1950s. And that is, and probably going back, you know, even to the 19th century with the advent of the mixed pews that began in Reformed temples. As I said earlier, how did it really begin? It was really mimicking the churches, right? And Soloveitchik was, and so Soloveitchik felt to therefore have mixed pews is a violation of the biblical principle of b'chukoseichem lo teilecho, about chukas akum, about following the non-Jewish practices. Soloveitchik, now, this is something most people don't follow, most shuls don't follow. Soloveitchik felt you shouldn't even have stained glass windows in synagogues. He felt, again, that was just mimicking the church. So again, obviously lots of shuls do that. But nonetheless, the Soviets felt that the mechitza was certainly a violation, a biblical violation of Chukas Akum. And I just want to point out one thing that I think very important right now, and that is Soloveitchik and Ramosha Feinstein were saying these things in the 1950s and 1960s. And you know, others were arguing with them. Others were saying, oh, you know, where exactly is the real source of this? Actually, one of the fascinating, whenever anyone discusses this issue of mechitza, everyone points out, you know, there's a big question. In fact, the Tzitz Eliezer asked this question explicitly. The problem is, where does it say anything about mechitza in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law? Right? The Code of Jewish Law has everything in there. So it's interesting, I'll save you some time. There's no mention anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch about mechitza. So everyone says, you see, it's not so important. Now, the Tzitz Eliezer answers that two things. Number one, there's many things that are not in the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, between Minchah Maariv right now and Shul, we're learning Simen Kuf Nun Vav in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Mishnah Berurah Dal, where there's this lengthy, lengthy Mishnah Berurah where he lists mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah that's not included in the Shulchan Aruch. Most of them are Beinam L'Chaveiro, but for that reason, Yosef Karo didn't include everything. So Tzitz Eliezer says, okay, so there's another thing he just didn't include. Or the other possibility is that it's so obvious. It's like, of course the shul has a mechitza. Again, that shul's always had mechitzas. It's just, you know, there's not even a debate about that or question mark or like why. So there was no need to mention it in the Shulchan Aruch. Be that as it may, with Soloveitchik, back to the point I wanted to make about the history, Soloveitchik and Moshe Feinstein, they were battling the future of Orthodoxy in America. Again, if you those of us who didn't live back in that time, you know, Orthodoxy, you know, there was a question whether it would survive in America. Some were predicting, you know, that it was going to vanish and disappear. And you know, we owe all that we have today in our Orthodox Jewish communities to people like Ramosha Feinstein and people like Soloveitchik. And lay leaders who stuck to the guns and didn't give in to temptation, and they maintained traditional Orthodox values, those who founded yeshivas and day schools, and there's an expression in Koheles of Chacham Einav Barosho, that a wise person has eyes in their head, or the another expression in Pirkei Avos of Shimon, who says that a wise person is someone who's a roas anolad, someone who can foresee the outcome. Right? Sometimes when people want to make changes, these people, in the 1800s, who got rid of the mechitzas, they weren't bad people. They were people who were thought they were doing good things for Judaism. I always tell my students, I'm teaching now American Jewish history. These are people who are proud Jews. Right, these early reform leaders, these people, they thought they were saving Judaism. They really thought the L'shem Shemayim. So, you always have to understand that and recognize that. And yet at the same time, I read an article once from Emanuel Feldman, of course, the famous rabbi who was in Atlanta for so many years, now lives in Israel. He wrote an article saying, he titled it, Save Me from the Saviors. The people are trying to save Judaism, but they don't always realize what they're doing. They think they're doing a good thing, but really they don't. They think it's like playing chess. You have to think a few steps, moves ahead of you, and what you think is a good thing, you're actually are destroying things. So, Soloveitchik and Moshe Feinstein, is it really a mitzvah d'oraisa to have a mechitza? One can argue on the technicalities, but they had to say what they said because they literally saved Orthodox Judaism. They literally saved Orthodox Judaism with insisting, because it wasn't just mechitza. Mechitza was just one thing of something much larger. And therefore, it was critical to for Jews to understand, what Orthodoxy, what traditional Judaism is, and to remain in a traditional shul, because once the mechitza goes, lots of other things went as well. Again, and they understood that, and we owe them our eternal gratitude for the strong position that they took. I mentioned earlier, Soloveitchik, so famously, and again, it's just to show whether halachically what he did was correct is debatable, but it's more than halachic. It was saving Yiddishkeit. Famous thing, and he himself wrote about this in an essay. He said a young man came to him when he was in Boston, and had the following question. He he was going to be in a place for Rosh Hashanah where the only shul was a shul with Adam Achitza, with mixed pews. And there would be someone, and he only could hear shofar blowing at that synagogue. There was nowhere else to go. The person who was blowing shofar wasn't available to blow for him privately. And the person knew how to blow shofar, it was totally kosher. A person at a kosher shofar knew the halachos. So he asked the Soloveitchik, could he just go into the conservative, I guess it was a conservative shul, just to hear the shofar blowing? And the Soloveitchik said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. He said, you may not enter into that, even though you're going to be missing the mitzvah d'oraisa of tkiyah shofar. He felt Shev al Tasa better stay at home, and they miss it. Now that's, again, it sounds astonishing to us. You know, one could maybe legally, halachically argue with the Soloveitchik. But again, you have to understand that there's something bigger issues at play and what the Soloveitchik was doing in terms of saving Yiddishkeit in America by taking such a strong strong stand. There are other opinions. I'm not going to go through all of them. There are other suggestions as to additional reasons why we have mechitza and perhaps other violations. If one does not have mechitza, removing minhag Yisrael for centuries. But nonetheless, again, it's old established practice. Again, perhaps even according to a Soloveitchik and Rosh Feinstein, a mitzvah d'oraisa to have mechitza in a shul. Okay. So now the question is, what is a proper mechitza? Right. So I'm sitting behind the mechitza Young Israel Southfield. It's a pretty tall mechitza here at the Young Israel Southfield. From the men's section, it's well over 70 inches. From the women's section, it's over 60 inches, over 5 feet. Pretty tall mechitza. And yet, it's a see-through mechitza, right? Not great see-through mechitza. It's very dizzying with its current design that hopefully will change when we change in the mechitza, which we'll get to in a moment. But the question is, what makes a mechitza a kosher, a valid mechitza? So the problem is that there's a contradiction within the opinion of the Rambam as to what the purpose of the mechitza is. In one place, in this commentary in that Mishnah, in the Maseches Sukkah, he says, why do you have a mechitza? He says, k'dei shelo yistaklu hanashim benashim. It's in order so that the men don't see the women. An underlying seeing, that the men should not see the women. That's what he says in his Parsha Mishnayos. However, in two places in his Mishnah Torah, which he wrote later in life, when he was already in Egypt, he writes the following, Kidei shelo yu muravim. It's in order that men and women shouldn't mix. They shouldn't mix together. Now, there's a major difference between those two opinions. Right, and the classic nafkamina difference would be, can I have a glass mechitza? A glass mechitza will prevent people mixing, but clearly you can still see one to the other. So there's at least three different approaches how rabbis try to reconcile this contradiction within the Rambam. First, most extreme, is the Divrei Yoel, the Satmar Rebbe, if you all talk about, who said, very simple. He says, when men are looking at women, that's intermingling. And men should not be looking at women. And therefore, the Rambam is consistent, that it's all the same thing. The bodily, you shouldn't be looking at each other. That leads to intermingling. It is intermingling. And therefore, a mechitza has to be such that men and women cannot see one another. Moshe Feinstein, however, said the following. And there's several tshuvas where he writes this, where he says, if there's no partition, so then looking at each other could lead to mingling. You see someone, you want to go over and talk to them. But if there's a partition, that will prevent the mingling. So therefore, if there's no partition, then I got a big problem. Then you shouldn't look. But if there's a partition, then no problem. So in other words, he says this explicitly. And he was asked a question. He was asked, is it okay to have a mechitza that see through that has a glass? So he's not so excited about it because he said he's worried about when the women come to shul, are they dressed tzanua? Are they dressed modestly in terms of dress, and that's something to Now, that's another consideration. But assuming everyone is dressed, modestly, and men should also be dressed modestly, of course, then he says, no, the issue is basically one of mingling, and therefore having a glass mechitza is acceptable. There is another opinion, and that's of the Tshuvos Mishnah Halachos, the Menashe Klein, the Ungvar Rebbe, who, interesting, so a quick aside, was someone who was always had a lifetime connection to Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, they had two of them were in Auschwitz together. And then after the war, they were in France together, and they were a little different, hashkafically, to say the least, but they always kept a very close connection. So, but Menashe Klein, he felt both are problematic. Right? Looking is a problem, and mixing is a problem. Both require mechitza, said the Menashe Klein. Some suggest very simply, and this place whenever we have a contradiction between the Rambam and his parish of Mishnayos, is Mishnah Torah, we just say simply, he changed his mind. Again, he wrote his Mishnah Torah later in life, and so some just say, okay, maybe he thought the issue was looking, but later on he said the issue was mingling. Bottom line, what's the halacha? So the halacha is, it depends who you follow, depends who your posik is. If you follow the Sadma Rav, you follow Menashe Klein, and you follow many Hasidim and many Hungarian poskim and a little more yeshivish poskim, they're going to say the issue is stockless of looking. And therefore, if you go into a Hasidish shtiblach, a major Hasidish base medrash, you go into many yeshivas and more Haredi shuls, you're going to have a mechitza that literally the men cannot see the women because they follow this opinion that's an issue of histoklus. If you go into a shul like Young Israel Southfield, for example, where men can see the women, women can see the men, so obviously we're following the opinion of Moshe Feinstein. Now, the question then is, okay, so how tall then? How big does it have to be? If the issue is just a separation, so, how big does a mechitza have to be? So some wanted to suggest, well, look at other areas where a mechitza is required, where a wall is halachically required in Judaism. Where else is a wall required in Judaism? How about a sukkah? How tall does a sukkah wall have to be? So the minimum height is pretty small. It's just 10 tefachim. How much is 10 tefachim? 36 inches, maybe 40 inches, 41 inches. Pretty small. A little more than 3 feet. We also, an Erev, you have a wall with an Erev. Erev also only has to be 10 tefachim tall. A makkah, the fence on a roof, you have to have a makkah, also 10 tefachim. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed. He felt it has to be taller than that. He felt, and he said, and he writes this explicitly, he felt it had to be 60 inches or 5 feet. Why 5 feet? Because that's like, seems like somewhat arbitrary. He felt that when we mean preventing intermingling, it means like not only like a barrier, but like that nothing should be passed from one side to another. Sometimes you see, people are talking in between the mechitza. That's not supposed to take place. Nothing should be, you shouldn't be passing anything. So 5 feet, Moshe was a pretty small person. So for him, 5 feet was like probably like a giant wall. He felt that was like tall enough to prevent things being passed from one side to the other. Most shuls follow Moshe Feinstein. However, not all. You go to even to some Orthodox synagogues. I remember I grew up in a shul where it was, I believe it was smaller than 5 feet. Rasolovejic once was asked the question, and there's the whole debate amongst his students whether he said this as ideally or just b'dieved. You have to ask your local Rasolovejic student as to what they think his real opinion was. But he did say it in writing. We know that his daughter wrote it and that he signed his name to it. He felt 48 inches. He felt four feet. Now, where he got 4 feet from is unclear. Was he being strict on 10 tefachim? Was he felt that was enough of a separation? Unclear. He didn't really explain himself. But most shuls today, Orthodox shuls, when they're being built today, usually at least follow Moshe Feinstein's opinion of 5 feet. And again, that's what we have here at Young Israel Southfield. And Moshe made one other very important point, because we have this here in our shul, Young Israel Southfield. 5 feet from where? From the men's section or from the women's section? So it's very common, like we have here in Young Israel Southfield, there's a couple steps up to the women's section. I said before, when I started, that for the men's section, it's very tall, the mechitza. I think it's like 70 inches. And for the women's side, it's a little, I think, above 60 inches. So Moshe felt it had to be from the women's side. It has to be at least that tall. So at least 5 feet tall from the women's section. Okay. Now we're coming towards towards the end. Just to show you, those who do require that there shouldn't be any looking, once to get that dimension and see into the women's section, we know that the famous Kitzur Shulchan Aruch at one point actually had 70 rabbis in Hungary sign a letter forbidding anyone to enter a shul, not only a shul that didn't have a machitza, but had a machitza where the men could see the women. So, it's a well-established, when you go into a shul and you see it's a little extreme, there's many who follow that approach, that the men should not be looking at the women. Again, our shul, we don't follow that. We follow the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein. There is a discussion also amongst the poskim, is it perhaps better to have a one-way mirror, or a glass where you can see, where the women can see the men, but the men can't see the women. My experience is in non-Orthodox shuls that are a little bit more yeshivish, or yeshivish shuls that are a little bit more open, for the women having to have better visual sight of what's going on, they have those type of machitzas. They have machitzas where the men can't see the women, but the women, there's all these interesting ways with technology how you do this, where in many different creative ways, where the women have a clear, are clearly able then to see what's happening in the men's section. And again, some say that's ideal, and some say it's not necessary. Again, I'm just presenting the different opinions that are out there regarding a mechitza. One thing that's clear is that, when there is a mechitza, there's never a universal agreement in mechitza, because everyone wants something different. Everyone's looking for something a little different, design. And, the question always is, just in terms of, structurally creating a mechitza, how do you create a mechitza? If we do encourage the women to see that they can see clearly, also that sound is not an issue, and things of that nature, and also what would be the reason for the men to see into the women's section? So I it could be it's a comfort that you see your wife is there. It could be for security reasons to be able to see one another in today's day and age. But in any event, again, lots of different opinions about halachically about the mechitza. And then just aesthetically, in terms of what a mechitza should look like. Just to end off, a couple final points. Do you always need a mechitza? So this is like a whole separate question. We spoke about the Gemara and Kiddushin at a funeral, at a wedding. So again, there's different opinions about that. Again, the Gemara seems to imply that men and women should be separate at those types of places. Even at a shir, the Gemara seems to imply perhaps the men and women should sit separate. There are different opinions. Rav Moshe Feinstein, he actually had an interesting position. He proved it from Korban Pesach. He said, what happens with Korban Pesach? Families would eat the Korban Pesach together. Now, we don't see anywhere that the Gemara says that they had a mechitza down the table, and men are on one side, women on the other side. So he felt when there's like a smaller gathering or gathering by invitation, that didn't require a mechitza. And therefore, he was of the opinion, in fact, it's noted historically, that at his own children's weddings, there was no mechitza. Apparently, again, this is what I've been told, I wasn't there, but I've read about it, that there was no mechitza at his own children's weddings. There is a separate question. If there's no mechitza, maybe still men and women should sit separately. In fact, Rasal Beitrik has this middle ground that I mentioned before, that he felt that perhaps Minat Torah, there was a biblical requirement for men and women to be together, and the mechitza was like the siyag, was like a rabbinic fence. Play on words, it was literally a fence around the Torah to protect, the shouldn't be any mingling. But the biblical requirement is sitting separate. The rabbinic requirement is then putting the mechitza to maintain that biblical requirement of there not to be mingling between men and women. Again, so Rav Moshe seems to imply that something by invitation does not require a mechitza, perhaps like a wedding or something like that. Some say, whatever, we have a temporary minion. I just had this recently. We were visiting my parents in Florida. We went one day, took the kids to the Miami Sea Aquarium. So, yeshiva break, there's tons of Jews. I never forget, over 20 years ago when we lived in Florida, we went to Orlando. They had these great deals if you're a Florida resident to get into the Disney parks. as yeshiva break. I don't think we even realized it. And literally every ride, you can get a mincha minyan, around the clock. There's like so many Jews there. So when you have a minyan like that, do you have to put up a mechitza? Let's say some women want to daven. So we generally assume no, that if you have such like a temporary minyan, you know, on an airplane, for example, you know, you don't have to, again, men and women shouldn't be davening together, but you don't have to put up a mechitza. Now, what's interesting is recently during COVID, when we were davening outside, so those became more permanent minyanim, right? Those weren't just, you know, davening, you know, at the Sea Aquarium or at Disney World, but that was, you know, going weeks and months on end davening outside. So that probably would require a mechitza in such a situation. Again, you know, you see from that story with Yitzchak and Rivka, there was mechitza down the middle. They were davening, you know, they were spontaneously davening, and Yitzchak was on one side, and Rivka was on the other side. In conclusion, one final point, there was a very beautiful article that Dr. Norman Lamb, the former, the late president of Yeshiva University, he wrote in 1959 and published in Tradition, where he was defending why Orthodox shuls have a mechitza. Again, these major battles were taking place at that time between literally the survival of Orthodoxy. So he writes the following, and I want to end off with this comment that he made. He says, a Jew approaches God out of solitude and insecurity, relying completely upon him, God, for his very breath. Because when we daven, right, we are, our lives are hanging in the balance. We have challenges and we don't know where to turn, and we're confused and we're frightened and we're scared, and we're turning to God for salvation, for assistance, for help, for our very lives. And so he continues, Dr. Lamb, and he writes, this complete concentration on God, this awareness only on him and nothing or no one else, is what we call kavana. This is kavana. Without kavana, prayer becomes just a senseless repetition of words. Because ultimately, it's about recognizing that I'm standing before God, and I'm totally focused on God. So he writes, he says, mixed pews lead to a distraction and their frivolity, which undermines one's kavana. Right? When you're together, men and women together, so it's going to take away. And it's interesting. I often say that, I mentioned to Jane Vesky earlier today, I always mention, in theory, even when men daven together, we should view it as we're davening as a tzibor, but sort of like we should be in our own separate cubicle. You're not supposed to be talking to the person next to you. Besides, it's not appropriate in the shul. It takes away from your focus, your kavana, that you're having this private conversation with the Ribono Shalom, with the gods. Again, we do it as a community. God loves when we come together and pray and as in a minyan and a tzibor. But at its core, the Shmoneh Esrei is a private conversation with God. And therefore, the reason, at least within the context of a shul, to have a mechitza is to be able to, it's to help us. It's not to hinder us, and it's not at all sexist or anything. It's just to help us to recognize what we're doing in shul. Shul is not a time to being with family. It's not a time to hanging out with friends. It's a time to commune with the God. If you want to talk, I always say, that's why God invented the hallway. The hallway was invented for talking. The shul, where the mechitza is a place for us to have a conversation, a private conversation with the Ribono Shalom. And the mechitza helps that. It's there to assist us in what the purpose is of why it is that we're coming to shul and we're coming to daven. So to wrap things up, you know, what we discussed a little bit the history of the of mechitzas, and that from as far back as we know, certainly back into the Middle Ages, it was just a given. Shuls had balconies, mechitzas. Things began to change in America in the 1800s, and perhaps there was a reaction to the churches, what was going on, and Jews trying to fit in. Major battles took place in America in the 1950s, even court battles regarding whether a shul was allowed to remove a mechitza if it was there previously. And again, a lot of it had to do with the survival of traditional Judaism in America. I think we owe our eternal gratitude to people like Rasal Vachek and Moshe Feinstein and other rabbinic and lay leaders who fought for Orthodoxy. We are all the beneficiaries of their vision and their commitments. You know, our parents and our grandparents who sent us to day schools, built day schools. You know, they were people thought they were fighting a losing battle, but we are here because of them. And so for we and again, you know, if one could argue with some of the logic of Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik, you have to remember that some things are meta halachic. Chacham ina baroshel. Sometimes you have to see where things are going. And why something, maybe you could argue halachically that something may be acceptable, it doesn't mean it's good for the Jews. And that's something for us to remember even in 2022, today's day and age. But sometimes there's innovations that people want to create. Sometimes innovation in Judaism is good. Yehuda HaNasi saved Judaism by being innovative, by writing down the oral law, the Mishnah. But sometimes people with the best of intentions wind up undermining it. And you need that's why we go to our Chachamim, Tamini Chachamim. That's why we go to our Gedolei Ador, who have that vision of Kol HaTorah Kula, and that recognition of a sense of our past and our future and our present, and connected to Hashem in such a profound way, who can guide us and help us, again, when we have best of intentions, but we don't always realize where those things are leading. And then finally, we discussed the halachic issues of, you know, where Mechitza comes from, that Gemara in Sukkah, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, and perhaps it's a prohibition of Chukas HaAkum, you know, nowadays to remove the Mechitza, but it's only to have a Mechitza. And then, you know, the question of how tall the Mechitza has to be, whether it's supposed to prevent seeing or just to prevent mingling, or let it have the see-through Mechitza. All these various issues that always have to be considered when constructing and having a mechitza, and then again, ultimately to understand that prayer is all about our private conversation with Hashem. And the mechitza, it's not like some argued that the mechitza was like a chicken. People, they literally use these terms, those who were against the mechitza in the early, late 1800s, they called it like a chicken coop and other like, you know, very derogatory terms. It's not at all what it is. It's just a separation, allowing men to focus on their davening, women to focus on their davening, and ultimately to allow all of us to do what we all need to do, and that is to connect and go and have and develop a stronger relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the one above. Okay, I want to thank everyone. It's great seeing you, and God willing, we will soon be renovating our shul here at the Young Israel Southfield, including coming up with a new design for the Mechitza as well.